Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hi there, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes.
Hey, I'm Christine Leo.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
And tonight, I'd like to welcome you to another thought-provoking episode of Deterrence Down Under, where it's Friday night here in Canberra. Our special guest today is Hugh White, who's an emeritus professor of strategic studies at the Australian National University. There, his work focuses primarily on Australian strategic and defense policy, Asia-Pacific security issues, and all kinds of other relatively massive topics. Hugh was the first director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, has held senior roles in defense, worked as a journalist for a stint with the Sydney Morning Herald, and spent time in the Office of National Assessments. So today we've got an excellent discussion lined up, focused on China's rise and growing nuclear capabilities and how the region is thinking about responding to that growth. So to kick us off, Natalie's going to give us a quick overview of the growth in China's nuclear capabilities. But first, I want to give you a reminder that the views of the hosts and the guests are their own and don't represent any institution with which we may be affiliated. So Natalie, over to you on China's growth.
So as of today, we estimate that China now has about 500 nuclear warheads, and by 2030, they'll have approximately 1,500 nuclear warheads. These are being produced in sort of more diverse nuclear delivery systems, and this creates complexity when we're looking at China's nuclear capabilities. One of the other things is that China's also looking at, or they've begun implementing a launch and warning posture called early warning counterstrike. The PRC probably seeks to at least to keep at least a portion of its force, especially its new silo-based units, on this launch and warning posture. And since 2017, they've exercised this capability.
So thank you, Natalie. Hugh, would love to hear your thoughts. So we had Jim Stokes on an earlier episode talking about, you know, China countries, director of NATO nuclear policy, sorry, you know, just that, no pressure. And we were talking about the idea of, like, countries that have traditionally had smaller nuclear arsenals expanding, countries such as China, maybe Pakistan, India, who knows, the nuclear age is still young. But I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on the implications for Australia about China's expanding nuclear arsenal, because we have, like, Australia has been used to living in such a quite unique and relatively stable nuclear order, and we can unpack that later, and sort of, you know, as you taught me as my PhD supervisor, you know, Australia has always kind of, modern Australia as we understand it today, has always kind of existed in a region dominated by a Western maritime power. And what does it mean for Australia to be challenged in that way, where the Great Britain and the United States thereafter are not dominating the region and are being challenged by Chinese nuclear expansion? What does it mean for how we think about deterrence, our own security and extended deterrence, and how does Australia exist in such a world?
Yeah, well, they're the big questions. Well, first, thanks, Christine. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Natalie, to have me on your show. It's a great pleasure to be here and a bit of an honour to join some of the very distinguished people that I know you've had on before and talking about some of my very favourite topics in the whole world. So, Christine, of course, you're right. You know, the starting point for this from an Australian perspective, and I would say more broadly from a regional perspective, the perspective of our neighbours, is that we do face a situation for the first time really since 1972, since Nixon went to Beijing and did his big deal with Mao. We face now, you could say perhaps since the late 2008, 2009, I think that's what the historians will judge, is the moment in which China went back to doing what it had done before 1972, and that is actively contesting America's position as the primary role in East Asia and the Western Pacific. And that is huge for Australia and huge for the rest of the region, because America has been the dominant power in East Asia and the Western Pacific for so long, You can have a little historical seminar about when exactly that began. You could say Manila Bay, 1899. You could say 1945 with the defeat of Japan. But at any rate, for a very long time, and for really all of Asia's modern history. And the only challenge that there's been in that period has been Japan, but Japan was, although a very formidable challenge at the time, in the long run, it was never going to win. It's funny because, just to use one very crude measure, its GDP was never bigger than about one-fifth the size of America's at the height of the imperial Japanese challenge. China, of course, is a completely different kind of challenge because its economy, on the most relevant measure, PPP, is the same size as America's. And what's more, this gets us closer to our core subject, its military capability, though in aggregate much less than the United States. Its air and maritime capabilities, and specifically its A2AD capabilities, its capacity to deny the United States the capacity to project power into the Western Pacific, into the Chinese littoral, has grown to the point where it is much more equal with America's than Japan's was, except for that 6 months between Pearl Harbor and Midway, really. And so we do face a very different situation. My very sort of blunt way of describing our fundamental situation is that the US and China are now actively competing over which of them is going to be the primary power in this region over the decades ahead. And that because the stakes are so high, this is, after all, the two strongest powers in the world competing over which of them will be the dominant power in the world's most dynamic region. The stakes don't get any bigger than that. It seems to me to be almost inevitable that that contest is going to end up being primarily military. It's not to say there won't be other dimensions, there's ideological, there's soft power dimensions of various sorts, there's economic, of course, but it's going to end up being primarily military. That's not to say that they'll necessarily go to war. You know, we've all read the Thucydides Trap story. We've all read Graham Allison. We know that great powers, rising powers, challenging established powers don't always go to war, just usually. But what is true is that the contest between them always has a primarily military flavor. And so when they don't go to war, it's because one side's backed off. And so I think the big, the big dynamic that we face in the region is that as the US and China confront one another in this epic contest, the question as to which of them can persuade the other that it is more willing to go to war or more willing to win that war and can therefore deter the other from prosecuting its side of the challenge becomes, I think, the central question about the future of Asia. And that means for Australia, of course, a central question about the future of our strategic doctrine, which has, not just since the rise of American power, but indeed since European settlement back in 1788, has always been founded on the idea that the necessary and sufficient condition for our security is the continued domination of the Western Pacific, our whole region, by an Anglo-Saxon power, because it's a historical accident that that's always been the case. First Britain, which was, of course, the globally dominant maritime power and the dominant maritime power in East Asia from 1788, when Australia was first settled by Europeans. And then as British power faded, American power rose. And so we've always had this, what we Australians call great and powerful friends, Anglo-Saxon, English-speaking great and powerful friends dominating the region. So for us, China's rise and its challenge to the United States constitutes the biggest challenge to the basic bedrock foundation of Australia's strategic outlook since European settlement. So this doesn't get any bigger for us as Australians. Now, sorry, that's a long preamble, but to get to Christine's specific question. For a very long time, it seemed to me, sitting back here in Canberra, after the Cold War, after the relief of the easing of the very fraught superpower nuclear face-off throughout the decades of the Cold War, after the Cold War in the 90s and the 2000s, we really forgot about nuclear weapons. And there was a, you know, we could see, for example, in successive nuclear posture reviews, up until the Obama administration's NPR, there was the pious hope that
because of the preponderance of US conventional power in the post-Cold War world, nuclear weapons will become less significant. So we didn't really need to worry about it. And in particular, as the rivalry with China became more and more overt, became more and more central to US strategic thinking, particularly after 2017 with the National Security Strategy and the way in which the rivalry with China has moved to the center of the US strategic agenda since then, there's still been, until very recently, a tendency to just discount or even ignore China as a strategic as a nuclear rival. It's been a strategic rival, but it hasn't been at the center of people's consciousness that involved the United States going back to an intense strategic contest with a nuclear-armed state which had the capacity to put nuclear weapons on American territory. And I think that's what's now catching up with us. That's what the more recent nuclear developments that Natalie mentioned have really brought to people's attention. I think the historians will look back and say that the sort of sudden realization of the big missile fields that the Chinese are building out in the West, the intelligence community's analysis about that unexpectedly sharp rise in the number of nuclear warheads, the shift in Chinese nuclear posture, again, as Natalie mentioned, the move to away from storing the missiles and the warheads separately towards having at least some of them married together in normal times. All of these suggest that China does need to be taken much more seriously as a strategic adversary and a nuclear adversary. And the other dimension of that is that for a long time, I think, people have tended to assume that because, as people keep on repeating, the United States has the strongest military in the world, that meant that the United States was going to be able to win any war with China in the Western Pacific and therefore deter any war with China in the Western Pacific purely through the superiority of its conventional capabilities. And that, frankly, there's no excuse for people having thought that, because that's been becoming progressively and manifestly less true very steadily for a couple of decades. And I think, you know, and everyone who does the war game comes up with basically the same conclusion. The United States can no longer expect to win a conventional conflict with China over in the Western Pacific theater over an issue like Taiwan or, for that matter, the South China Sea. That's not to say it necessarily loses. What's most likely, it seems to me, and I think this is in aggregate what the war games tend to show, is that after a relatively short period, a couple of weeks really, of very intense exchange, intensity of maritime conflict of a sort that we haven't seen since 1945, both sides would have suffered very big losses and neither side would have achieved a decisive outcome. Both sides would therefore be left asking themselves, what the hell do we do now? Both sides would have invested so much and lost so much that the idea of backing off becomes unthinkable, and therefore both sides have very strong incentives to start asking, do nuclear weapons present us a way out of this problem? And I therefore think that the risk of a nuclear war, of a conventional war between the US and China in the Western Pacific, walking right up to the nuclear threshold and very likely going over it, is quite high. And that leads us to the conclusion that if the United States is to do what it wants to do, that is to deter China from challenging the United States militarily, say, over Taiwan, and therefore deter China from striking a decisive blow against the credibility of the whole US strategic position in the Western Pacific, it has to not just be able to convince the Chinese that it can win a conventional war, it has to convince the Chinese that it's willing to fight and win a nuclear war. So we are kind of back to the Cold War again. In fact, just like in the Cold War, the United States had to develop a whole nuclear posture and doctrine around the fact that it couldn't expect to win a conventional war in Europe against the Soviet land forces. Now it has to do something a little bit similar, though of course there are important differences, convincing the Chinese that even if it can't win a maritime war in the Western Pacific against China's maritime forces, it can still prevail because it can prevail. It'll fight and win a nuclear war. Now my sense is that the United States nuclear posture at the moment is very far from being able to do that. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of American strategists have woken up to this over the last year or two, and so we've seen this, you know, onrush of prestigious groups of people producing very important reports on this subject, and which make very interesting reading. But I've got to say, I'm a bit skeptical about whether they've yet come up with the right answer.
Very good scene, Senator. And yeah, one of the challenges for the United States is, you know, if it was to get engaged with China over nuclear warfare and was to expend a significant amount of weapons due to New START limitations at the moment and the current force structure, there aren't enough to take on the other gorilla in the room, which is Russia. And the United States ends up in a very bad place if considering both those adversaries.
Yeah. Now look, that's exactly right, Carl. And I think, you know, one of the things that gives the present, I think, quite spectacular resurgence in debate and concern in the US about the adequacy of its nuclear posture real bite is that, of course, the China story is huge, and I think is generally acknowledged in Washington to be the biggest story in town, but it's not the only story in town. We've found ourselves, of course, with Russia over Ukraine facing a very real, well, you could say quite literally that actually Vladimir Putin has been using his nuclear weapons ever since the invasion, because it's the possession of those nuclear weapons which has done so much to constrain Western support for Ukraine. You know, right back at the beginning, Joe Biden said that he wasn't prepared to fight World War III over Ukraine, and we know what he meant. He meant he wasn't prepared to fight a nuclear war over Ukraine. And so, you know, that has, if you like, given nuclear weapons a salience in a key strategic question, and Ukraine might be a second-order issue compared to China, but it's still a very big issue for Europe, of course, but also for global order. And so the fact that nuclear weapons have played such a significant part of that, and that Putin's threats to use them have been so overt and explicit, that itself, of course, is very worrying. And then there's North Korea. And I do think the North Korean story adds another dimension, the fact that North Korea, but you know, well, US, I think, strategic policy makers must now assume that North Korea has or will soon have the capacity to put nuclear warheads on a few American cities, and you know, and a few is enough to impose a very real constraint on US decision making. And I think that's a whole different, whole additional dynamic. So, you know, I think, Carl, you're absolutely right. On the other hand, you know, that the fact that the United States faces this collective first time, of course, and I mean, very realistically, if the US Intelligence Committee's estimates are right, and I think if anything they're likely to be an underestimate, then within a decade or so, which in the world of the development of nuclear capabilities is not very long, the United States will face, in effect, two peer nuclear competitors. And that is, of course, everyone keeps on saying, a new situation. And so I think that does raise very big questions, as you suggested, Carl, about whether or not the United States has actually got enough shots in the locker. But I don't think that's the only question. And I'm not even sure it's the most important one, because it does seem to me that the real problem for the United States is not so much that it doesn't have enough nuclear weapons to sustain a strong deterrent posture against two or three nuclear adversaries simultaneously. It's not that it doesn't have enough weapons. It's that I don't think myself it's done nearly enough to convince its nuclear adversaries that it's willing to use them. Now, you know, we all know we've all done deterrence 101. And so, you know, we all know that deterrence requires both capability and demonstrated resolve. You've got to persuade the other guy both that you got the stuff and that you're willing to use it. And being willing to use it means being willing to accept the consequences of using it, including the other guy using it back against you. Now, you know, the Cold War and the strategic nuclear balance throughout the Cold War remains for all of us the kind of definitive textbook about this stuff. And so it is worth asking ourselves, you know, what happened in the Cold War and what can we learn from that? Well, the great, remarkable achievement of the Cold War, which is now so much part of our history and our experience, at least those of us old enough to remember, that we sort of take it for granted, is that the United States convinced the Kremlin that it was willing to fight a nuclear war, which would involve very high probability of nuclear attacks directly on American cities, in order to protect the United States position in Europe in detail. it was prepared to fight a nuclear war over West Berlin. Now, you know, how did it persuade the Soviets that it was prepared to accept nuclear attacks on New York, Washington, Philadelphia, you name it, in exchange for West Berlin? Well, we know the, you know, we know the answer. There's an answer. It was a huge national effort, which involved, and I think there was a lot of dimensions to it. It was the enormous effort the United States went into building the conventional forces that went into Europe. It was the enormous effort it went to building the nuclear forces that underpinned its deterrent posture. It's the way in which US political leaders talked about the issue, very explicitly telling American voters that they would have to, that the defense of their position in Western Europe would require them to fight a nuclear war, which would involve the attacks on US cities. And the fact that American voters kept on voting for politicians who told them that. Every 4 years, they'd say, yes, well, every 2 years, they'd say, yeah, okay, we'll vote for these guys. Now, that was an extraordinarily potent message to the Kremlin. And my big worry is that neither the Kremlin nor, for that matter, Zhang Nanhai, or the guys in Pyongyang, for that matter, have heard American political leaders talking like that, have seen American decision makers committing to the kind of nuclear forces that they committed to in the Cold War, nor have they seen them commit the extraordinary levels of effort that required to build the conventional forces that stood, if you like, in front of those nuclear forces. And so my concern is that when the guys in Zhang Nanhai, or for that matter in the Kremlin, ask themselves, if we push up against and over the nuclear threshold, will America really strike back, knowing that we can then counterstrike the continental United States? They have much less reason to think, yes, they will, than their colleagues and predecessors in the Kremlin did in, for example, the Berlin crisis of 1961. And that makes me worried. So if I was sitting across there in the Pentagon or in the NSC, the first thing I'd be thinking about is not how quickly can we build more nukes, but what do we need to do to persuade the Chinese and the Russians that we're
Hugh,
really
can
able
I ask
to use them?
Can I ask you a question about this? Because I think you make a really great point there. So, for example, like this is obviously, you know, sort of like presidential prime minister level strategic communications, as in the president must come across convincing enough that he is prepared to use nuclear weapons. But like, what do you think the role is of someone like, say, Chief of Joint Capabilities, Lieutenant General Susan Coyle, in her information warfare role in Australia, and how should Australia be either developing those communications or having those conversations with the US, and or should we be looking at the ambassador level? We currently, because I was looking at developing an article on, you know, do we need to split out our ambassador roles? Should we be looking at strategic deterrence separately from the arms control portion of our ambassador roles, or should we have like a separate ambassador like we do in the cyberspace? That is an independent ambassador that can have those conversations. Because currently, when you look at the public conversations, they're held at the FAS level. And, you know, is that too low down? Is that person having to do too much in the, like, arms control space versus the, hey, we actually need to either be nuclear sharing or communicating this deterrence message across as well? So I'd be really interested to hear
it's a really good question, Natalie, and I mean I think the answer is quite complicated. So I think three parts to it. The first is that the thing that really communicates strategic resolve is not what you say but what you do. So I personally think the most important thing the United States did during the Cold War to communicate strategic resolve to the Soviet Union was to spend 7% and 8% and 9% of GDP on defence for years, for decades, was to fight a number of very big wars, not all of them terribly well informed, but, you know, the fact that they fought Korea and Vietnam certainly, you know, left an impression. These people weren't kidding. And of course, the fact that they built this extraordinary nuclear arsenal, you know, they invented ICBMs. They invented SSBNs. You know, to look back at what the US technological and industrial, and for that matter, military and administrative machinery did in creating the US nuclear arsenal in the 50s and 60s. It happened incredibly fast. I mean, it was a remarkable achievement. If you compare, for example, with the timeframes required in the overhaul of the US nuclear posture under the present plan, you know, I mean, God. So that's the first point. I think, you know, the in some ways the most important communication is the demonstration of what you're actually doing. And I think there's a message for that for both Australia and for the United States. The United States has talked a lot about the confronting China and taking China on as a strategic rival in the Western Pacific. But I don't think it's too unfair to say there's been no material improvement in no strategically significant improvement in the US military posture in the Western Pacific since the 2017 National Security Strategy. And you know, not to put too fine a point on it, I don't like to seem too narrow-minded here, but the fact that the United States has declared a first-order strategic rivalry with a country that is a more powerful rival than any country it's ever faced before, just because it's got a bigger GDP, which really counts for something. And yet it has not engineered a significant increase in the GDP share of its own defence spending, sends a message to Beijing, which I think is the wrong one. If the US had bounced back, even up to the levels it was spending when it was taking on Al-Qaeda and Iraq, so back to 5% of GDP, up from 3.5%, that would send a message to Beijing. But the fact that the GDP number is continues to go down the graph, that's a bad demonstration. That's the first point. And there's a big issue for Australia there as well, because although our political leaders have spent a great deal of time and spilled a great deal of ink telling us all that we face the most demanding strategic circumstances since 1945, we're not doing much. If you ask Australian political leaders what we're doing, they're saying AUKUS. Well, don't get me started on AUKUS. That's a different subject. But with the best will in the world, and even if it all works, that's going to start increasing our capability in, let's be generous, 15 years from now?
We're doing a lot of paperwork. It's like paper tigers.
Paper tigers, exactly. So, you know, that's a long way of answering the point about messaging. You know, the first thing we could do is really start, taking the strategic objective we've set ourselves of containing China's challenge seriously. The second point is that I do think the most important communications are, as you mentioned in your observation, the ones that come from the top. Nothing beats a president or a prime minister standing up there and saying, this is what we're going to do. Now, my model of head of state/government communication on these things is actually Kennedy's speech to the nation, not the one we all know from 13 days, the Cuban Missile Crisis, but the one during the address to the nation he gave to the in July of 1961 at the height of the Berlin crisis. It makes your hair curl to read it even now. That was absolutely clear and unambiguous. And we need more of that. And the contrast is, and you know, please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going to keep saying this until somebody points out why I'm wrong. I don't think I've ever heard a US political leader explain to the American people that the defense of Taiwan would entail the United States running a significant risk of finding itself in a nuclear war against an adversary that can put nuclear weapons on Chinese cities. Now, that's exactly what US leaders, and for that matter, other leaders, said out loud during the Cold War. And that meant that the more clearly they said it, the more clearly the guys on the other side, the guys in the Kremlin, understood how serious the United States was. Now, for United States political leaders to not just say, you know, we're going to win the contest for the 21st century in that kind of language, but say, and this will entail us confronting a China in a standoff which might involve nuclear weapons. Now, if the Chinese hear them saying that, they'll take it a lot more seriously. But conversely, if they don't hear them saying that, then they're going to say, are these guys bluffing? And I think one of the scary things is I'm not sure they know whether they're bluffing or not.
Yeah. So to expand on that, both Japan and South Korea have considered this threat somewhat significant. They've gone to the United States and said, we want more assurance around extended deterrence and come to some recent agreements. Parts of those communities have even thought about building nuclear weapons. And Australia, if you look at the National Defense Strategy just came out, nuclear weapons is mentioned maybe once. And Australia talks about a strategy of denial against its adversaries. So how do we resolve this? How do we think about, you know, does Australia really need more assurance around extended deterrence or, you know, better thinking around nuclear issues?
Yeah, no, really good question, Carl. Look, I do think the predicament in which both the Japanese and the South Koreans find themselves is very significant. I think the South Korean predicament is particularly acute because, of course, they don't just have a China problem; they also have a North Korea problem. And I don't want to. I actually think that the nuclear standoff on the Korean Peninsula has got very, very interesting the last couple of years, and even this year. And you know that right at the heart of it is that as North Korea acquires the capacity to put nuclear weapons on U.S. cities, the credibility of U.S. extended nuclear deterrence goes down like that. Because, you know, extended nuclear deterrence is a perfectly credible posture against an adversary that can't attack the U.S. homeland. It's much less credible when there really is a question, are you going to swap Seoul for San Francisco? And that is now a real question. What struck me was that so I wasn't at all surprised that the South Koreans came forward to the United States and said, look, we want much more reassurance about the robustness of your commitment to us under END. And what really surprised me was that when the South Koreans made what looked to me like some perfectly reasonable requests, really to be treated the same as NATO was treated, with some of the mechanisms that NATO has, mechanisms, of course, that were left over from the Cold War, they turned up in Washington to negotiate the Washington Declaration. And on the really key things, like the redeployment of weapons to the peninsula and a real nuclear planning group with teeth, they didn't get what they asked for. Now, I just cannot understand why Washington didn't give them that. Well, maybe I can. Maybe they were scared of provoking China. But you know, surely they weren't scared of provoking Pyongyang. Whatever. I think maybe they were scared of provoking Japan. And that's a whole different story. But I do think that, that the erosion of confidence in extended nuclear deterrence amongst the South Koreans because of the North Korean problem is a very dynamic factor in the Asian nuclear balance. And, you know, and we can see that the obvious solution for South Korea, that is to build its own minimum deterrent posture, is now on the table. I mean, it's even been mentioned by presidents and ministers of defense, not just by, you know, crazy ratbag academics. And I think, I personally think there's a significant chance that the South Koreans will go that way. Let me put it slightly differently. I think if I was a South Korean strategic policy maker, I would be one of the ones who said, yep, we need to do this. And of course, if they take that step, then everything changes for Japan. But so I think, you know, the Japanese are essentially in the same predicament, two steps behind. Why hasn't Australia gone that far? Well, partly it's because not enough people have read Christine's book.
You encouraged me.
I know. But I do think that the unless the United States can do a great deal to enhance its deterrent posture in the Western Pacific, then I think the pressures on Australia to go in the same direction will continue to grow. Now, I don't think they'll grow as fast. And, you know, one of the reasons why they don't grow as fast is simple geography. We are a lot further away from the fulcrum of this stuff. I think it's also a matter of of the nature of the alliance, you know, because, if I can put it this way, the alliance with America has such deep cultural and personal roots and has none of the negatives that the US-Japan relationship has, you know. America did nuke the Japanese, after all, and has none of the complexities of the Korean relationship. It's a very, very warm relationship. Australians find it very easy, I think much more easily than our co-allies in Northeast Asia do, to just take America for granted. But that's becoming less true. And I do think that not this year or next year, but maybe in a decade or two down the track, we'll find ourselves asking the same questions and not necessarily reach the same answer because we're in an easier strategic position geographically, but I think we'll face similar pressures, the same questions will loom in our environment.
Hugh, do you think we're looking far enough ahead as well? And you sort of briefly touched on that because not only are we going to have at least six nuclear-powered states come on board in the next couple of years, we're going to have... We're seeing now much more energy around, particularly Russia sort of backing nuclear energy, and then there's China, and now there's also the US competing with that. But then, I mean, that I don't know whether or not that will directly relate to nuclear weapons, but are we looking far enough into the future too? Because we're sort of stuck on the Taiwan issue. We're not really looking beyond that. And, with the current problem with AUKUS and subs is that we probably should have been thinking about this when we were building the columns. Really, we should have been looking at what's the next thing look like, because it takes so long to develop these capabilities. I just get the sense that our current department is so tied up in the program, like our military is tied up in delivering programs and not necessarily focusing on what are the operational concepts and the functional requirements, not only in the current environment but then in the future. And then I like to call it the day after tomorrow, which is really like 10 to 20 to 30 years from now.
Yeah. No, look, that's exactly right, Natalie. And I mean, I think there's several dimensions to that. One is that we keep on, I think, planning our defence on the basis of a snapshot of our region as it is today. And of course, that's completely pointless because the forces we're planning today are the forces we'll deliver 15 years from now, and will still be in service 40 years from now. And so, for example, we're now all fixated on China, and we should be because China is a huge deal, but we're not paying nearly enough attention to the fact that India is a rising power too, and India is going to be a rising power, and we're going to have to manage a relationship with India, which in many ways could be just as complex as our relationship with China. And we're also not paying attention sufficient attention to the fact that Indonesia too is a rising power. Well before the middle of the century, it'll be the fourth biggest economy in the world. We'll have a great power then, not safely at a distance up there in Northeast Asia or South Asia, but right next door. And we can and should expect these countries to continue to develop technologically. The idea that Australia will always be more advanced technologically than them should long ago have been put to bed. And so I think you're absolutely right. When we see these countries, for example, moving into nuclear technology, that because, as you mentioned in your question, because nuclear technology is becoming more important anyway for reasons more related to climate change, we are going to live in a region which has a higher level of nuclear expertise and therefore shorter thresholds, timescales to move into nuclear weapons, and stronger in strategic incentives to do so as US extended nuclear deterrence erodes. So I think we're not paying nearly enough attention to that, and I think that's true of the way we think about not just our capabilities but also of our strategic relationships. I don't think we're taking nearly far-sighted enough view of the kind of strategic relationships we're going to want to have with Indonesia, for example, or with other countries in Southeast Asia, or for that matter, with Japan and India and so on. So I think, there's a lot of dimensions to that, and the fact that, exactly as you say, our defence system at the moment is very focused on delivering projects which are themselves conceived very much on the contemporary situation without really asking where are we heading and what are we going to need 20 or 25 years from now is I think going to mean that we're going to enter into a very difficult few decades, very unprepared.
Excellent, excellent. Hey, Hugh, it was a great discussion. I think we'd all love to just sit around and talk for another couple hours, but we'll save our listeners this time around. Maybe we can get you on another time in the future.
Sure. Well, thanks very much for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was excellent. So I want to thank our guest, Hugh White, for a fascinating discussion of China's growing nuclear capabilities, the U.S.-China strategic competition, and all the regional impacts associated. And thanks to our listeners for listening tonight, or today, or wherever you may be. And just remember to always think deterrence. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.